The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Happy New Year! This is Fred Brack from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known to you as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974, and underwriting our program for over 10 years. Thank you, Carter Glass. Want to talk to them? They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now, for the last time, we are going to return to the December 2019 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme, of course, has been Season's Greetings. And one of the things we've been doing is reading about holiday celebrations in the various cities. We will get to that in a moment, but we certainly want to do as we always do in the last reading of each month and return to the series 1950s, The Decade in Motion. So we will do that first. Our State's look at the people and events that shaped the 50s goes forward with progressive Governor W. Carr Scott, the Squire of Haw River. How a dairy farmer from Alamance County ascended the political ladder to become governor, then senator, never forgetting his rural roots along the way. Written by Philip Girard. North Carolina enters the post-war decade in a roil of aggressive politics, pitting old guard heavyweights against upstart progressives. The crisis of war is over, and with it the focus on the war effort at the expense of other programs. There's a lot to be done for businesses, schools, roads, and social needs, and robust arguments arise about what should be addressed first, at what cost, and how should it be paid for. Out of the hurly-burly of politics emerges a dark horse, a leader of bold vision and plain speaking, a dairy farmer from Alamance County named William Kerr Scott. He goes by Kerr, pronounced Carr, so I will correct myself, fitting for a man who will become famous for building roads. Scott is a farmer's son, born on April 17, 1896, before the turn of the 20th century, before the rise of automobiles and the invention of the first successful airplane, before the Great Depression and two world wars. He built his own home and dairy farm less than a mile from the farmstead where he was born, the sixth of 11 children, to Robert W. Farmer Bob and Elizabeth Hughes Scott. Farmer Bob was actually politically sophisticated. He served on the State Commission of Agriculture under seven governors, hosted Governor Charles B. Eichhoff in his home on several occasions, and was a two-term state senator and five-term representative. His son has inherited his political savvy. Carr Scott is a devoted Presbyterian, a lifelong student of the Bible, and also a pragmatist with vision who can see not just an ideal future, but also what is possible in the here and now. Politics is the art of the possible, and he is gifted with the ability to make more things possible. He is impatient with the ruling powers, which to him are unquestionably concentrated in the cities, favoring big business over the needs of common people, rural people. In conversation, he is deeply attentive, but he speaks his mind directly, even bluntly, although always with an old-fashioned courteousness. He has a sturdy farmer's build, curly dark hair often worn swept back from his high forehead, and thick eyebrows that give his smile a boyish, mischievous look. He is equally at home in a pinstripe three-piece suit or denim overalls and a straw hat. As Commissioner of Agriculture for almost a dozen years, he has earned a legendary reputation for knowledge and competence. In 1948, he sets his sights on the governorship. Among other politicians, he inspires either fierce loyalty or total enmity, rarely anything in between. But his real constituency is made up of ordinary people on farms and in small towns. He becomes their champion in an impassioned speech in Asheville just 3 days before resigning as Commissioner of Agriculture and formally announcing his bid for governor. He advocates for significantly extending rural phone and electrical service, improving schools, and undertaking a massive project to pave farm-to-market roads. He calls his daring program Go Forward. His critics warn that his grand spending program will bankrupt the state. His backers call him the Squire. The Squire of Haw River is still a good listener, a deep student of what he hears and reads. And then when he makes up his mind what should be done and how it should be done, he goes out and does it, writes Robert Redwine, his biographer. Introducing a volume of his speeches and letters, many of them responses to the more than 300,000 letters sent to him by citizens. Scott's credo is simple and persuasive. What is bad for any large segment or group of the people is bad for all the people. In these dates of one-party democratic supremacy, the primary, not the general election, is decisive. Scott's gubernatorial opponents are two. R. Maine Albright, a liberal war veteran running as an anti-machine candidate, and Charles Johnson, the state treasurer, endorsed by the party's establishment, including a majority of legislators. Johnson edges out Scott in the largely three-way primary by fewer than 9,000 votes. But Scott campaigns on brilliantly, connecting with people around the state with his down-to-earth manner, relating folksy anecdotes tailored to local audiences that illustrate the problems of bad roads and poor schools. Scott attracts the backing of progressives such as Terry Sanford, a Fayetteville attorney and future governor. In the runoff, Scott picks up most of the Albright faction and wallops Johnson by almost 35,000 votes, carrying 65 counties, a clear and stunning mandate. He enjoys especially vigorous support in rural counties, and his most ardent supporters become known as the Branch Head Boys, referring to those who live far up the creeks or branches and away from towns. In the general election, he carries 73% of the vote, nearly 112,000 more than Harry Truman, running at the top of the ticket, receives in North Carolina. As governor, Scott is as good as his word, shaking up the status quo. He appoints the first woman to Superior Court, Susie Sharp, then goes on to appoint more women to boards and commissions than any previous governor. Though he has remained committed to segregation, he appoints the first black man ever to serve on the State Board of Education, Dr. Harold Leonard Trigg, former president of Elizabeth City State Teachers College and current president of St. Augustine's College. To his critics, Scott responds, "Compromising almost one-third of the population of our state, and with 30% of the children attending our public schools being their children, the Negro race is entitled to and should have representation on the Board of Education." Scott's progressive ideas are vigorously opposed by a group of hardcore conservative legislators who caucus after hours and call themselves the hold-the-liners. Limited by state law to a single term, Scott accomplishes an amazing record in just 4 years, 14,810 miles of roads and highways, which is more than was paved in all the decades before his inauguration. 1,000 new classrooms, 175 new gymnasiums, and 350 lunchrooms in public schools. An annual appropriation of $550,000 to fund a health program in public schools, and more than $300 million of capital improvements in state colleges and universities and hospitals serving patients afflicted with tuberculosis and mental impairment, as well as general community hospitals, 4,406 new beds in 77 hospitals, serving 73 of the 100 counties, some of which have not previously had a hospital at all. Under Scott's administration, the deep water ports of Wilmington and Moorhead City come online at a cost of $7.5 million. Remarkably, he accomplishes all of this, raising only one tax, a penny per gallon of gas, to fund roads. He leaves the state treasury with a surplus of $40 million, which gives him special pleasure, having been accused of attempting to bankrupt the state with overambitious plans. In the private sector, nearly 400 new industrial plants have been built, employing almost 40,000 workers. And in keeping with his promise to make life better for the Branch Head folks, they now enjoy more than 30,000 new telephones and more than 150,000 new electric connections. In his farewell radio address on December 30th, 1952, Governor Scott reminds his audience, "The people are sovereign. When the shouting and tumult is over, their expressed verdict always prevails. Oftentimes, the thinking of the people is far ahead of their political leaders. This has been demonstrated time and time again." He goes on, citing the statistic that just one-third of North Carolinians live in cities. The other two-thirds constitute an impoverished, mud tax-afflicted rural population that makes poor customers for any trading center or metropolitan area. He continues, "I became a candidate for governor because of these two convictions, that rural North Carolina was a land of forgotten people, and that what is bad for two-thirds of the people is bad for all." When he describes nearing the end of the row that we have been plowing together for the past 4 years, his voice falters and breaks before regaining vigor and volume. He concludes, "May the God of us all be with you and with North Carolina forever." In 1954, he successfully campaigns to unseat Alton Lennon and fill the unfinished term of Senator Willis Smith. Meanwhile, William B. Umstead succeeds Scott as governor. 2 days after his inauguration, Umstead suffers a heart attack and remains bedridden for more than 4 months. In October 1954, a severe cold turns into pneumonia, and on November 7th, he dies of congestive heart failure. Lieutenant Governor Luther H. Hodges serves out the remaining 2 years of Umstead's term and wins election to a full term of his own. In the U.S. Senate, Scott continues his progressive agenda on a larger scale, championing a world food bank to ease the suffering of millions of starving people around the globe. He testifies, "Well-fed and well-clothed masses of people cling to their freedoms, fight for increased dignities for the individual, and never succumb to the false promises and siren songs of the Frankensteins who fashion the creeds of shadowisms." At home for Easter vacation in 1958, Scott suffers a heart attack. He's taken to a hospital in Burlington, where his doctors expect him to recover, but he takes a sudden turn and dies on April 16, 1958, the day before his 62nd birthday. At his Senate memorial session, Senator Lyndon B. Johnson of Texas says, "Carr Scott loved people. Carr Scott's love was not an abstract academic love. He wanted to do things for them because he was one of them. And they responded in full measure to his devotion." In the wake of Scott's unexpected death, the editors of the Carolina Times of Durham write, "This newspaper did not always agree with Carr Scott. In fact, there were times when we disagreed with him most vehemently and took him to task in these columns. But Carr Scott was a big enough man with whom one might disagree without having to suffer subsequent reprisals at his hand. He was no yes, yes man. And he didn't like such around him. Only a strong man can have power in his hands and not use it to destroy those of us who are weak. The Greensboro Record says simply, Carr Scott had faith in the people, and the people had faith in him. Perhaps the most eloquent eulogy comes from the Winston-Salem Journal. Carr Scott is dead, and yet he lives. In every nook and corner of North Carolina stand monuments to his life and handiwork. Every rural school, nearly every farm home, has in some way felt the influence of the simple but blunt-speaking man whose life and character so clearly exemplified the official model of the state, esse quam videre, to be rather than seem. That's the end of the article. Next January, which means next month, the Dixie Dynamo barrels into the 1960s. So I guess that means we're going to be at the end of the series on the 50s and starting one on the 60s. You are listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments on our program, please call 919-832-5138. And now we're going to go back to some of those Christmas in the Towns stories. We'll get two of them in. I don't know if we'll quite finish the second, but let's give it a try. And we're going to start in Charlotte with Warm Fuzzies. Watching the Leonard Bernstein Symphony Orchestra play holiday standards never gets old, even when the kids do. Written by Jen Tota McGivney. They're moving! Micah Blatchford didn't expect this. The 4-foot-tall plush bears in the orchestra before him lift their heads, blink their eyes, and adjust the musical instruments and microphones in their hands. Pause. The other children don't need Micah to point this out. The moving bears command their full attention already. But Micah, wearing reindeer antlers and a Batman hoodie, revives his alert to the masses, this time with emphatic pointing. They're moving! They're moving! Indeed, Maestro Leonard Bernstein turns and announces to the 20 children gathered at the small white fence around the stage that the show will begin in 2 minutes. Then the bears freeze in their poses. 2 minutes means very little to kids. Somewhere between right now and never. So they wait, barely blinking, in case it means the former. Never before have I seen so many toddlers so quiet and still for 2 minutes. In a row. Before the spell is broken, the fuzzy players come to life again, performing It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year. Children hold on to the top rail of the fence while jumping up and down. Some sing. A couple of jaws drop open. Micah stands still, eyes fixed on the bears. He had been right all along. This is my fourth year seeing the Leonard Bernstein Symphony Orchestra. Each December I come to the atrium at Founders Hall Mall in Charlotte with my family. 3 generations of us. My niece Sydney and nephew Henry come to watch the bears. The rest of us come to watch Sydney and Henry watching the bears. The show never changes. It's a 45-minute set of Christmas songs performed by 18 animatronic bears. Performances occur a few times per day, increasing in frequency as Christmas draws nearer. It's free and no tickets are necessary. Just show up and settle into a place on the floor or onto a bench and wait for the bears to begin. The first year, Henry was a baby, sleeping through the performance in his grandma's arms. Sydney was 3, and when Frosty the Snowman and Jingle Bells began, she leapt up and did the little kid shimmy. All hips and elbows, that instinctual dance that children do when they hear their jam. We've come each year since, and each year I marvel. Kids shouldn't like this, I think. Kids who have screens full of crazy computer-generated special effects should have higher technological standards. Surely when I was a child in the 1980s, I loved few things more than a raucous show by Munch's make-believe band, the animatronic Chuck E. Cheese performers. But those were simpler times, back when Teddy Ruxpin amazed. How is it that an animatronic doll still captivates little eyes? Yet they do. And the only proof one needs is how earnestly these kids applaud the bears at the end of each song. This isn't about bears, of course. This is about magic. Maybe that explains the divide in this audience. A lot of children under six, a lot of adults watching those children, but not many ages in between. The little ones are too young to realize that magic isn't real, while their parents and grandparents are old enough to wish that it were. The fact that the bears continue to perform well into the digital age is, I suppose, its own sort of magic. This is the orchestra's 20th anniversary. The band has never broken up or broken down. These are the original bears, meticulously cared for by Todd Alexander, who's been involved in the show all along and has run it for 6 years. He grooms the bears' fur and carefully lint rolls their costumes. His wife Jessica helps him set up and take down the bears, teases that Todd treats them like his children. Their kids, when small, used to call them Daddy's Bears. Todd notes that drummer Gene will need a new sequin jacket next year. It seems faded, he says. I'm standing a few feet from Gene, and his jacket looks just fine to me. Todd programmed these 18 bears 2 decades ago when he barely knew how to turn on a computer, he jokes. But he taught himself enough programming to choreograph the show so that each mouth moves to the lyrics. Trumpeter Wild Bill stands on cue for his solo, and Gene drums to the beat. Their eyelids move at random. Each year, Todd attends the show as an audience member to see the kids jumping by the fence and singing along, the parents cracking smiles. To be a part of creating Christmas magic is no small privilege. I still think that make-believe is big, he says. A lot of people think that the bears are scary-looking or hokey, but the people who get it are the Christmas fans. They're the ones who decorate their houses, who go all out, who love to celebrate. On the same block, just around the corner, is the Belk Theater, the principal home of the Charlotte Symphony Orchestra. Patrons should know a few distinctions between attending LBSO and CSO shows. For one, attendees can talk, sing, dance, and even race each other during a Bearstein performance. I've seen good-natured wrestling matches break out here. Belk Theater, however, frowns upon such behavior. The dress code for LBSO is come as you are. Some parents bring kids dolled up in holiday wear, girls in red tulle skirts, and boys in reindeer sweaters. Other kiddos come in sweats, tees, or pajamas. The bears don't judge. Jammies at CSO, however, might garner a little side eye. This year, like every year, we've come to LBSO in our usual December state. Frazzled, but full of holiday cheer. Only 4 of us could make it this time. Henry, Sydney, their mom, Maura, and me. We sit on the floor up front, surrounded by toddlers hopping up on sugar. Henry's now 4, and he uses the time between songs to try to con me out of a Christmas cookie he just gave me. Sydney's 7, and it breaks my heart to say it, a little bored. I think of her in previous years, bouncing in my lap with so much Christmas joy that her little body seemed at risk of exploding into tinsel. Now she's still. We're both a little bummed that things have changed. Sydney prefers to stand to the side of the stage, away from the little kids. I stand with her, wondering when the label stopped applying to her. To distract us from the irrevocable march of time, we analyze the bear's attire. Jean's sequin jacket is a fashion win, although we feel that black tie bears really should make the effort to wear shoes. Then the maestro begins Jingle Bells, Sydney's Christmas jam. Her eyes widen, and a smile emerges. For a few seconds, ever so subtly, she does the little shimmy. I smile at this gift of Christmas magic, a little girl dancing to the bears one more time. I hesitate to call out to Maura. She's moving. She's moving. Well, Leonard Bernstein Symphony Orchestra is or was at the founder's Hall Mall in North Tryon Street in Charlotte. If you want to see if they're still playing, visit spintasticsounds.com. And now let's move to Concord, which was pronounced Concord if you were studying the Revolutionary War and talking about the Massachusetts town. Switching gears, Charlotte Motor Speedway turns into the slow lane at Christmas time, even when NASCAR drivers downshift to take in the sights. We're not going to get through this article, but we'll see what we can learn so far. This is written by Jen Tota McGivney again. Justin Allgaier usually drives the track at Charlotte Motor Speedway at more than 100 miles per hour in a Chevrolet Camaro SS for JR Motorsports in the NASCAR Infinity Series. Last December, however, he drove this track in a Chevy Tahoe for someone else, his 5-year-old daughter, Harper. Allgaier's family had come to see the lights, the many, many lights at Christmas or Speedway Christmas. Allgaier, like all the drivers on the track that day, took his speed down to single-digit levels. It's funny going around the Speedway Christmas racetrack as a driver. My first instinct is to drive onto the banking and show them what it's all about, Allgaier says, but that's not an option. So he explored parts of the new Roval track at a much slower pace. He visited the Christmas Village in the infield to enjoy an apple cider, typically not the drink of choice on the infield, and he introduced Harper to Santa Claus. Allgaier has been on this track more than 20 times, but on Speedway Christmas he experienced a whole new place. You go there and think, wow, they've taken one thing and turned it into something else that's completely cool, he says. This year marks the 10th anniversary of Speedway Christmas, when Charlotte Motor Speedway transforms into a glowing wonderland. It's no small feat to fill this massive speedway with light displays, but 4 million bulbs managed to do it. Lighted displays curve the lines. Last year's storybook theme had a big bad wolf huffing and puffing, but not blowing the piggy's house down, and left Captain Hook dangling over the tick-tock of the crocodile before an amused Peter Pan. Each year's display is different. This year it's Santa's Safari. If the car radio is set to 101.3 FM, those inside the speedway experience the blinking lights synced with Christmas music. In the center of the track is a Christmas village. Open Thursday through Sunday, visitors can leave their cars to visit a live nativity, toast s'mores over fire pits, and of course get a picture with Santa. Tonight, however, none of those attractions can compare with the simpler thrill, the fake snow falling on guests as they enter the village. I've never been so excited about snow in all my life, says a little girl about 8, as she runs in circles with her arms raised. All around her, children scamper and stomp to leave footprints in the dusting. Charlotte Motor Speedway, that's going to be there through January 5th. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and this broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions? Call the studios, 919-832-5138. So long. Until next time.